Why not consider becoming a supporter of Film Network Ireland on buymeacoffee.com/FNI and sign up to become a member so you can benefit from all sorts of little extra perks. Tickets for screenings, tickets to our meetups, discounts and so much more. You'll find more about us on social media, on Facebook and Insta on @FilmNetworkIreland. As always, we are excited to bring you exclusive interviews with some of Ireland's top filmmakers, actors, and industry insiders. If you enjoy our show, why not deep dive into our back catalogue for a varied and exciting look behind the scenes of what it's actually like to work in the film and TV industry across all departments on the island of Ireland. Rap Chat is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you find your audio content relating to film and TV.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the FNI Rap Chat podcast. My name is Luke Brabazon and today we'll be talking to Aoife Kelleher, who is director of the upcoming documentary Mrs. Robinson, which follows the life and the work of the first president or first female president of Ireland, Mrs. Mary Robinson. We'll be talking about a lot of things that I think would be very interesting, especially to younger documentary directors or people that are looking to understand how some of the Irish industry might work, or how you might look to the different ways that people manage to build themselves a career as a documentary director, the sort of the ups and the downs that can kind of come with it, all the different aspects of how you might sort of work your way from, you know, film school and up from there. And Aoife has a lot of amazing things to say about this topic, so I'm really looking forward to getting into it. So yeah, without any further ado, let's get into the episode. Hi Aoife, welcome to the studio. Thank you very much for coming in, and congratulations on the film Mrs. Robinson. So it's out soon, August 23rd, and I saw it recently. I thought it was fantastic, so I'm really looking forward to other people getting to see it as well, because it's, you know, it's a very important film about a very important person who cares about very important things. I think it's fantastic. But I thought I'd start this by talking a bit about what got you into filmmaking in the first place and what sort of got you from there to where you are here.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you very much, and thank you so much for being so kind about the film. So I had initially thought that I was going to study law or English, and kind of while I was dithering between the two of those, my now sister-in-law was making her student film in DIT Angel Street on the film and broadcasting course there. And I sat in with her for a day while she was directing that, and it threw off the course of my entire life. So really that was it then. So I studied on the same course in Angel Street. And that was it really throughout the entire course. I thought I was more interested in drama, but after I graduated, I immediately started working in documentary. So that was it.
Okay, and what was it about the documentary side of things that got you more interested in following that?
Yeah, I think that it's really just about kind of life experience and realizing that the real people's stories are as fascinating as they are. I love that documentary gives you the opportunity to have really kind of deep or unusual or intense or, you know, offbeat conversations that might not be possible otherwise, and to kind of really get to the heart of what matters to people, you know, and have conversations that really wouldn't be possible otherwise. You know, I think I think it's such a privilege to work in it, and, you know, I just find it endlessly interesting.
Yeah, I think the real life stories are always more, or I have always thought for myself, they're more interesting than anything I could try to write myself. And it is a really interesting sort of career path, in that the people that you get to meet and the stories that you can sometimes be allowed access to are really amazing things. And then it's a real privilege to then be able to be the person that can sort of tell those stories on to the rest of the world, I guess. And with a lot of your work, you have often dealt with people that deserved a lot more attention in the past, and now you're sharing these stories, a lot of them sort of about Ireland's slightly darker past in the last 50 plus years. And I noticed that being a bit of a through line in your work. What sort of brought you in that direction?
I mean, I think I always had, you know, an interest in social justice, I suppose, you know. And I mean, I think it's very, I think anyone who's been exposed to stories about, you know, for example, Ireland's institutions, or, you know, the kind of, you know, treatment that some people were exposed to in Irish society, and really, in a lot of cases, so recently, like, in relation to, for example, Magdalen Laundries, the last one closed in the mid-90s, you know, or the decriminalisation of homosexuality, which also was in the mid-90s. I think that, you know, we're really in a period of kind of reckoning with how many people were treated throughout, you know, the first 100 years of the Irish state, you know, and you know, the ways in which we really made each other miserable. And, you know, I'm just kind of drawn to those stories, you know, and you know, I think that it's, you know, what is wonderful about documentary is that you can spend time with someone and kind of really, you know, kind of get a sense of, you know, the real nuance, the real impact that, you know, kind of, treatment or kind of mistreatment or oppression or, you know, whatever it may be, you know you get to spend time with someone and really see kind of the impact that has had. I've been asked before, you know, why I don't make work on lighter subjects, but yeah, it's just, you know, you you're drawn to where you're drawn, and you tell the stories that fascinate and compel you, you know, and that's just those are the stories that I've ended up telling.
Yeah, you know, that's fantastic. And I guess with a job like this, so much passion does need to go into it. It would be very difficult to put that amount of hours or that amount of time into a project if it wasn't something that you really cared about, sort of the core of it, or felt the importance of sort of telling that kind of story. I noticed, while I was sort of watching through some of your previous stuff, I noticed Barry Keoghan in a very early appearance in a short film for Belong To, is that correct?
That's right, yeah. So I directed Barry. It was shortly after, so the first kind of, you know, my very first piece of directing, or, you know, my first work as a director, was a two-part series for RTE called Growing Up Gay. And, you know, as part of that, I would have spent time with, you know, in Belong To, and with the young people who Belong To were working with. And so following that two-part documentary series, I made a short piece for Belong To about homophobic bullying. So Barry, I mean, actually, what happened was Kirsten Sheridan had been working with Barry and recommended him. And I mean, he was extraordinary then. He was, you know, he's magnetic and charismatic. And, you know, it was an extraordinary, I mean, it was the first piece of drama that I'd done since college. So, working with him was extraordinary. And actually, that was co-directed with my sister-in-law, Anna Rogers. So we worked on it together, and we both met Barry. So that was really extraordinary. And actually, so I've While making Growing Up Gay, I worked with Ruth Negga. Ruth Negga did the voiceover for Growing Up Gay. So yeah, so a surprising number of Oscar nominees during the early stages of my career. Yeah,
yeah, it's amazing. Well, we're lucky to be within a community of very talented people. So what was started the, what got you from, you know, graduating film school to being, to getting directing projects like this? Like, what was the sort of years there? Because I know a lot of people sometimes find that challenge once they come out of film school. They're sort of wondering, well, what's next? Where are the jobs?
Yeah, I mean, so I graduated in 2004 and I directed Growing Up Gay from 2008 on. So that was from 2008 to 2010. I was kind of at a complete loss, I think, in the early years as to how to get things rolling, you know, and how to start working in the area that I really wanted to be working in. I did literally like work my way up. So I started work. I worked in RTE as a runner, and in the independent sector on a couple of independent productions as a runner as well, and then started work as a researcher. And it was while I was working as a researcher in Crossing the Line with John Murray and Greystones that I pitched the series Growing Up Gay to him, and he brought it to RTE and they greenlit it. So which all sounds very kind of smooth, but definitely in the, you know, after a year or two working as a runner, I thought, I have no idea. I had begun to kind of despair at the idea of, you know, forging any kind of career path. So I did go back and do a master's, and I was briefly going to venture back into academia. But yeah, the lure of documentary was too great. So I was really fortunate that not long after I finished the master's, I got this directing project, and things were relatively straightforward after that.
Very good. I actually worked with John and the guys for a year or so after college as well, down in Greystones while they were still there, and they are, they're fantastic.
Yeah, so it's really, a really great, extraordinary place to work. I mean, they are so passionate. Definitely. I mean, the Growing Up Gay, the two-part series, was a real departure for John, and I think it confirmed his desire to only ever work with in the wildlife area after that. But I mean, the work they do is so extraordinary and so beautiful, and you know, it was a really inspiring place to be a researcher and afterwards a director.
So that would be sort of, as I understand it at least, that's often quite a, sort of a path that makes a lot of sense for people to take. So within the documentary field, one of the roles that's really needed is a researcher, and someone that can gather up the relevant information that then can be worked with within the documentary or within whatever project's been worked on. But I wonder if you could talk a bit more about the role of what a researcher does within a documentary production. We're going very technical and very kind of,
yeah, I mean, so I listened to, I know Ken was on the podcast, Ken Wardrop was on the podcast a while back, and, you know, he spoke about kind of the role of a researcher in his films and, you know, sending, you know, the researchers heading out to charity shops in Port Leash and Port Arlington. And, you know, it's very hard to quantify in certain respects. I mean, you know, I mean, sometimes it can be about, you know, going out into a community and letting people know that a documentary is being made, and just ensuring that everyone is very kind of comfortable with the idea and doesn't feel, you know, that their privacy is being infringed. So I worked as a researcher on a series that was in the Rutland Centre. So you know, which is a kind of rehabilitation center for people who are in addiction. And a lot of my role as researcher was just letting people know that that there was a documentary taking place, that, you know, that you know, people would only be featured or filmed if that was something that they wanted, and, you know, and that ultimately the aim was that their, you know, their rehabilitation and that their time in the Rutland Center wouldn't be disrupted in any way. I mean, it can be about, you know, talking to people, you know, finding kind of unusual stories, you know, creating word of mouth. I mean, it can be, you know, as Ken discussed as well, about kind of, you know, liaising with organisations in a particular area. I mean, I really enjoy doing my own research, actually. So, you know, I think that I've always found it, you know, or certainly being involved in that process insofar as, you know, spending a bit of time, you know, whether it's in a community, with a group of people, with a family, you know, and kind of whatever may have been your sense of what the story was, you know, while you were writing your pitch, while you're writing your treatment. I mean, that can often change during the kind of the research and development process, you know, and it's a part of it's a part of the process that I really like to be involved in.
Okay, and I suppose then, yeah, you are very much working out what the real story will be. And I think one of the great things you can get out of documentary is the depth at which you can kind of explore things, both as the filmmaker, when you're able to hopefully spend a lot of time with these people to really understand their stories, but then within a film, you've got your hour and a half, or, well, depending on the length, it can be any amount of time, but hopefully enough time that you are able to give sort of a deeper picture of something than you might if it was another form of media. So was it soon after that that you made 1 Million Dubliners then, or?
Yes, so it was, so I made, so Growing Up Gay went out in 2010, and 1 Million Dubliners, yeah, so that was, it was, that process began, you know, about, I think it was about 2 years after that. So that was, I mean, that one was just, I mean, so much of that experience, I suppose, until the end when it became more complicated, but so much of that experience was really wonderful, you know. So I'm a Northsider myself, and, you know, Glasnevin, O'Connell's Tower, and all of that was really kind of part of my skyline always, you know. So being able to spend so much time there and getting to know the people there, getting to know the stories, you know, understanding the significance of it, you know, beyond, you know, initial preconceptions, and it was incredible. It was an incredible experience.
Okay, yeah, it's I think there is a lot of value in making projects about things that you know at least a bit about, or that you've got some sort of kind of cultural understanding of, and I think that often leads to a lot more trust within the from the people that are featured on camera as well. Do you have any particular way that you might work with someone that isn't particularly camera or experienced with dealing with media or being on camera? Is there certain ways that you might sort of make someone feel more comfortable and ready to sort of be vulnerable with the camera? Is it very much a sort of case by case and trying to meet people where they're at?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in general, like, The more time that I've spent working in documentary, and, you know, the more time I've spent with people, the more I keep using the phrase, no worries if not. Insofar as I really want to provide people with a platform to tell their own story and to talk about what they want to talk about, and talk about experiences that they may not have discussed ever before. But only if that's what they want, and only in the way that they want. And, you know, Ken talked about the idea of duty of care. And, you know, like, I mean, from the beginning, I mean, with Growing Up Gay, we had kind of layer upon layer built into the process, whereby, you know, we would check in with contributors and, you know, and in this case, I mean, it was young people who were talking about their sexuality in a time before the marriage equality referendum, where, you know, attitudes in Ireland were quite different. You know, there was a sense that I remember talking to people who, you know, who felt it was wholly inappropriate to even talk about the idea that, you know, that young people in secondary school, for example, would have any awareness of their sexuality. Or of, you know, LGBT plus identities or anything like that. So it, you know, whether it's talking about you know, kind of sexuality or gender identity, or, you know, with the feature documentary I'm making now, in, where it's in relation to experiences in institutions. I see documentary as providing the means for people to tell the stories that they want to tell. So if they want to, you know, we'll talk about, you know, or try to make it as conversation as possible, and to enable them to tell the stories that they want to tell. But there's very little preparation. I mean, I think that, you know, the interview for me is kind of really the central part of the process of making a documentary. And I really just want it to be about someone telling their story the way they want to tell it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Excellent. I do agree. I think if there's any sort of forcing of things going on, well, it's very clear and it's very awkward if any of that stuff is sort of broadcast and shown. So it's always something to avoid, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, at least in this kind of work.
Absolutely. And that's what I just keep saying as a mantra now, you know, and like, no worries if not, and you don't have to if you don't want to, and, you know, we don't, and if there's anything you don't want to discuss, and I really do think that's so important. And you know, the reality is that you know, often within documentary, people do want to tell, you know, or to talk about their lives and experiences, and, you know, maybe they're kind of anxious about the process, and it's only through the interview that they realize, you know, what they want to tell and how they want to tell it. So, you know, on the documentary I'm working on at the moment, there were two women who weren't sure if they wanted to, you know, appear face to camera, if they weren't sure if they wanted their you know, their names to be mentioned, and, you know, that was completely agreed at the outset. But actually, through the process of doing the interview and conducting the interview and telling their story, you know, they experienced, you know, extraordinary catharsis, and have been telling, you know, have told it again and again since, and are really starting to own it. So it's wonderful, but you know, and extraordinary. But I mean, honestly, that doesn't necessarily happen every time. And, you know, it's not always, you know, people don't always find it cathartic to tell their stories, and people don't always, you know, necessarily want to, you know, be in the public eye. So, you know, it's about facilitating that and, you know, being willing to, you know, to lose contributors if that's what they want. And you know, with kind of duty of care always being paramount.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. And I guess that brings me around then to the next sort of question, would be, what would be the, how would you structure a production of a documentary then? So I imagine there's sort of the planning out, and of course you need to go for funding, and then you probably have a bit of an idea of what you're going to be doing. But then would the interviews come from there, and then that leads to a restructuring, or how, is there a sort of somewhat standard process that you might follow within this? Or, like, I'm wondering where the interviewing comes within the creation of this.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes, so for example, with Mrs. Robinson, the documentary really began with a series of interviews, so kind of 12 hours of interviews that ultimately formed the basis of the documentary. And obviously there was a lot of archive in that film, so, you know, that's a case of where, you know, in that kind of scenario, you have a very strong sense at the outset of what the story is going to be, and there's less of, you know, it's not really about finding the story in the edit in that kind of scenario. You know, it's about kind of, you know, putting all the pieces in place, you know, building it up with interview, archive, and, you know, any additional contributors. But but sometimes then, you know, I mean, obviously in a more observational documentary. I'm making a documentary now about the Justice for Magdalene's campaign, and that has been, you know, kind of in gestation since 2015. So, you know, there's a lot of filming has taken place over that time, and there is more of a finding the story in the edit, you know. Mm-hmm. So it kind of depends, really. I think it can be a combination of both. You know, you set out with a particular story in mind, but you leave room for serendipity, I think.
Mm. That's fantastic. And then how does funding work in a situation like that, especially when you've got one that's been sort of in development where you know, every day costs thousands, and then if you're still sort of, does it just require putting a lot of faith in the project, or would you have went for development funding first, or how did you approach that for the...
Yeah, I mean... So it's, I mean, again, it can be different every time. So for Mrs. Robinson, we were, that was funded by Screen Ireland, but also by a number of groups in America, actually. So so we had executive producers who were connected to Artemis Rising and a number of other organisations. So they stepped in. So we had tried for BAI funding for Mrs. Robinson on a number of occasions and we hadn't gotten it. So so we ended up looking at other kind of sources of funding for that film, which, you know, it was not something that I'd ever done before. I mean, for the most part, my feature documentaries have been funded through a combination of Screen Ireland and BAI and, you know, often RT as well, so it could be, mm-hmm. you know, that would have been the case with 1 Million Dubliners. So Mrs. Robinson was a little bit unusual in that regard, insofar as we had this, American funding as well, and a group of very kind of high powered female executives who were very interested in telling the story of Mary Robinson.
Okay, very good. I mean, it makes a huge amount of sense because, at least from the Irish perspective, we would assume the story about our first female president is a very Irish story, but especially what she does now, UN ambassador, and then more climate action, it is extremely international. And then, I mean, the film has very strong sort of empowering message, and I think a big thing that sometimes people might miss with funding is there's often more groups that will be really interested in the message that you're looking to communicate than you might first think. And in a way, it does make quite a lot of sense that there'd be other routes just outside, further than just within Ireland for funding for projects like this.
Yeah. I mean, you know, sometimes, I mean, it as I said, it's project to project. And, you know, I mean, in the case of the radio documentary that I made with RT, which was about Magella Moynihan, who was a guard who became pregnant as the term was, out of wedlock in the 1980s, and who was really pressurised by an Garda Síochána to give up her son for adoption. And you know, I had explored kind of multiple avenues of funding, and you know, but and it can take a long time. I mean, you know, as I said, the documentary I'm making at the moment, that was, you know, that was 8 years. Kind of trying to put the various kind of pieces of funding together, but Magella really wanted to tell her story, and she was really ready to put it out there. And so, in order to do it very quickly, you know, we did it as a radio documentary with really, I mean, micro funding. So it can. I mean, you know, the funding process, I mean, it can be frustrating, especially, you know, if there's a time sensitive piece. But when it's urgent, you know, you have to be willing to explore other avenues.
Yeah, it's, I guess, with a lot of, let's say, fiction films, like a script can be written and held onto, but yet the time sensitive nature can be quite serious. Like, you want to get someone while the most important and the most interesting thing is happening, or maybe they're just right now is the right time to tell a particular story. Like, it's, I think it might be something that will be seen in a lot of the things that you made now wouldn't be seen as any way sort of pushing the boundaries of where society is currently, or some of the older projects, but then at the time they were much more, you know, there was things that people needed to learn that we hadn't learned at that time, like the work with Belong To. Then put the Mrs. Robinson, then, like, the film kind of follows sort of vignettes. Like, there's a lot of major points within her life that we sort of see, and then there's a certain amount of commentary from the different interviewees sort of giving their sort of in a lot of ways trying to summarize a very full life and giving a bit of an idea of how the political landscape and the world around was. And how would you go about cutting down these 12 hours, or there might have been more than 12 hours in the end, of interviews? And would you sort of transcribe and then try and break it down from there, or?
Yeah, so I mean, we would have had, so it was 12 hours of just Mary Robinson herself, so then, and you know, additional, so that was before any of the other contributors were factored in, so it was just, you know, yeah, we would have transcribed them all and trying to kind of, you know, establish kind of the key moments. I mean, the aspects of her life that I was most interested in, you know, was like the kind of the early years of her career, which I, you know, would have been the aspects of her life that I knew relatively little about, you know, would have been aware of, you know, that she had been outspoken during the first divorce referendum, and you know, and would have been you know, very vocal as well, for example during the X case, but yeah, the fact that she had been really pivotal in ensuring that women would be granted the right to sit on juries, for example, in establishing a system for free legal aid, you know, so it was a really kind of fascinating period of her career, which overlapped with the Irish women's liberation movement, and you know, that extraordinary footage of the contraception train, where, you know, Niall McCafferty and other members of the liberation movement went up to the north and brought back down pills and condoms, and kind of dared the police to arrest them back, you know, when they arrived back in Dublin. So I mean, the footage is extraordinary, and it's, you know, it's amazing. And so you know, I mean, that was the period that I was, you know, really, really, you know, drawn to initially, and also her involvement then in the decriminalisation of homosexuality and her connection to David Norris. So that, you know, that was where we started, and it just you know, and then obviously that presidential campaign, which is so fascinating. There's an amazing archive as well. So, you know, working with the archive was a joy, really, you know. And it, you know, it's interesting the point that you made, that, you know, once certain, I mean, it can seem like, you know, when society changes and changes as rapidly as you know, Irish society has, things can be regarded as settled. You know, we get a sense of ourselves as being kind of, you know, progressive or tolerant or, you know, diverse or accepting. And I think it's really valuable to look back at, you know, how much things have changed and how certain key battles were won, and, you know, to get a sense of, you know, what has been achieved and how precious those achievements are.
Yeah, I think so. It's, like everything, watching through the film was sort of like a endless hits of just so many, so much hard work, so much dedication and so much perseverance. But I noticed also you didn't really shy away from some things that might be considered maybe not have been the best decisions, and it does give a much more rounded view of her as a person. And would there have been thoughts on kind of how, like, when you're choosing I don't know exactly how many sort of major keystone moments there are within the documentary, but I'm sure there were some things that needed to be left out, or would there be some sort of thought process in how, let's say, the dozen, if the different scenes feel like they're, I guess, authentically portraying Mary Robinson, or is it, I'm wondering how you choose which scenes are kept and which mightn't be made into story beats within the film.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think, I mean, it's an argument that you can continue to have with yourself afterwards, actually, and you know, and like, I mean, I know, like, so, you know, like Mary Robinson herself would be hugely passionate about, you know, climate, for example, and, you know, that is really kind of the issue to end all issues as far as she's concerned. And so, it would have been so myself and Cormac Cargadon would have pitched the documentary to her very much as a kind of a warts and all kind of unvarnished look at you know, her career. I suppose she was particularly keen on the documentary as, you know, as a means to kind of for her to kind of discuss, you know, the issue of climate justice. And, you know, my own areas of interest, I mean, the aspects of her story that as we've discussed, I mean, I was really interested in kind of, the early years of her career and kind of the sort of aspects that maybe hadn't been examined as much. I mean, I think that, you know, the first female president aspect of her story often means that kind of her role as a pioneering human rights lawyer maybe weren't looked at to the same degree. But I mean, there was never any question that we were going to look at, whether it's, the decision to leave her term as president early, or, you know, that we weren't going to discuss, her involvement in the case of Princess Latifah. There was never any question of whether or not, you know, we would address those. And, you know, it was really important to give her the chance to reflect on, you know, regrets as well as, you know, what would be regarded as kind of high points, you know. And, I felt it was, you know, vital that we would address those. You know, I mean, I suppose the presidency in a lot of ways, and as is discussed in the film, is quite a soft role. So, you know, I mean, it's, you know, you're kind of, it's a role as figurehead. It's not, you know, it's not like kind of being the Taoiseach or, you know, the American president or the prime minister. You know, it's the decisions that you make aren't necessarily controversial in the same way, but, you know, the moments, like, you know, whether it was the, you know, shaking hands with Gerry Adams at a kind of what it turned out was a really kind of pivotal point in Anglo-Irish relations, or, you know, or as I said, the kind of more difficult moments later on, it was really important to address those.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that does come back to something we were talking about earlier, which is sort of the trust and the connection that you have with your subjects. And in this case, I feel like it's often very important if you're making a documentary, to clearly communicate to someone, they guess so they can give kind of informed consent, but that they know, okay, I'm not looking to just make you look great, I'm looking to show, give an authentic view of things, and then that the person that you're filming trusts you in that.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that when you're talking about a contributor like, for example, Mary Robinson, it is slightly different to someone who wouldn't have been in the public eye. I mean, you know, she's had a very kind of a series of public facing roles. She has a public record to stand over. She's been kind of she's been answerable to the Irish electorate, for example. She's kind of had kind of really key roles within the United Nations. She's had her own foundation, and now she's a member of the Elders. So, I mean, you know, there is a sense of it's different to when you're asking someone to kind of step into the public eye for the first time and, you know, talk about, something highly sensitive or highly personal. I mean, this is different. I mean, it would have been a case of, you know, presenting the idea of a documentary, you know, to her, and then hoping that she would give you as much access as possible. I mean, there were times where, for example, she would say that she had just come back from Ukraine, and you'd think, why didn't you raise? it's different to the usual documentary, you know, where it's slightly more negotiated, and it's, you know, it's less about kind of facilitating, you know, someone telling their story, for example, for the first time. I mean, she's made documentaries before for Irish television, you know, so it's about, I suppose, encouraging her to present a new side to herself, or, you know, kind of to add to the record, and, you know, or, you know, kind of reflect on kind of aspects of her life that wouldn't have been discussed in the past.
Mm. That's a very valuable thing, to be able to sort of look back on things like that. And I'm going to smoothly tie that into the next question, which is, if would there be any advice you give to younger filmmakers, or, you know, maybe even yourself 20 years ago, 15 years ago? Is there things that you think, useful bits of information for making a way through this industry?
I mean, you know, I think that not waiting for permission is really important. And, you know, absolutely that you can be, you know, working your way up, you know, through an industry, but also that, you know, that you know, your voice and your perspective is really valuable right now. So you know, just make what you can any way that you can. And, you know, the same kind of avenues of funding that are open to anyone are open to kind of first time directors, and to, you know, take advantage of those as much as you can. I mean, you know, obviously there are certain kinds of stories that it's easier to gain access later on once you have an established track record. But, you know, there are always stories, whether it's kind of, you know, within your peer group or within your community, or, whether it's kind of online or within your family, you know, there are always kind of stories to be told that you know, and you know, I find, so I lecture in TU Dublin and Grange Gorman, and you know, I really, really love hearing, you know, my students talk about issues and kind of the really, you know, nuanced, insightful takes that they have on everything from, you know, social justice or political activism or current affairs. And, you know, I think it's really important that they push their way into the conversation as soon as possible.
Yeah, no, makes a lot of sense. Like, I think to want to be a director, you kind of need to have something that you want to say to the world, or something that you want to kind of communicate, or someone else's voice that you want to amplify. So, yeah, that does make a lot of sense. And then in terms of the sort of, let's say, the day to day, week to week, year to year of this kind of job, like, I know most of us, and something that I think I noticed in the last maybe 5-10 years, or at least when I started coming into the industry, it seemed at the start that people were starting to do multiple jobs or multiple roles. And at one point that seemed like a bit of an odd thing for someone to do, to be, let's say, camera operator, but then maybe also editing a bit, or also doing directing, or also doing writing as well. And I do remember that very much being sort of discouraged and a bit more of a, okay, pick a lane, let's stick to it. But now it seems like a lot of people are kind of covering quite a few different roles, or have, let's say, their larger projects they're looking to try and make happen, while then having more regular work that is coming in. And I don't know, I'm wondering, is that something, a change that I just was noticing as I was coming up, or do you think that is the sort of way that most people have found to make this job viable, by having quite a few different, let's say, revenue streams or routes?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think my experience has been that, you know, people don't necessarily pick a lane and stick to it. So, you know, I'm working on the documentary that I'm making at the moment. It's being edited by Ema Reynolds, who is also an extraordinary director. So I'm very glad that she hasn't stuck to the directing lane, you know, because she's an extraordinary editor and an extraordinary director, and, you know, and enjoys both. I mean, Cathal Waters, for example, who shot much of 1 Million Dubliners, went on to, you know, shoot Peaky Blinders, and has, you know, Love Hate, and, you know, has done extraordinary work in film drama and television drama. And there's, you know, there's also a reality. So, you know, I know directors who talk about, you know, you have this sense that you'll be able to kind of, you know, beautifully curate your oeuvre, and, you know, and but also, you know, and only take on kind of, you know, the most meaningful possible projects. But you do also have to, you know, pay a mortgage or pay your rent, and you have to live and you have to eat. So, you know, I mean, you know, whether that's, you know, Ken Wardrobe having, you know, an advertising wing and, you know, combining Antidote with Venom, or, you know, whether, you know, I mean, for a long time I combined work in film with work in television, and now, you know, now I lecture, which, you know, has been, you know, it's a really kind of energizing and inspiring kind of strand, I think. You know, it's great to work with students and really revitalizing. So yeah, and that's you know, I know a lot of other directors, so, you know, Anna Rogers, who we've mentioned, lectures, and, you know, as does, for example, Ross Whitaker. And yeah, it's about doing what you can to make it work.
Absolutely. And then also, I think, really being involved in your community as well. And I suppose through that, you're getting to see the next generations coming up, but then you're also getting to have regular contact with other people working, because I know, like, directing can end up being quite a lonely space, similar to, let's say, writers, where most of their work can end up just being sort of done on their own and kind of to a certain level of isolation, depending on how you make your work happen. But I've always found that the more you can be connected to the network of people around you, the better you are, but for the contacts, or for often just for the perspective, I think.
It's amazing. It's very it's like therapy sometimes, getting together with other directors and, you know, whining. It's, you know, or like talking meaningfully about the process and the various challenges. It's yeah, it's great. It's yeah, it's great to have a community of filmmakers to kind of, you know, to bounce ideas off and also to commiserate with, or, or, you know, it's yeah, it's really vital to have that community, I think. And yeah, so, like, you know, going into an edit with Emerels all the time is amazing. And, you know, and just, yeah, it's or, yeah, it's just really important, I think. It's really, really vital, because it can be very lonely, and it can be, you know, and there are lots of challenges, and and you know, and yet in so many ways the job is just a wonderful privilege. So the last people that anyone wants to hear whining are, you know, are producers and directors and filmmakers. So yeah, so it's very important to have people that you can yeah, you can really kind of, yeah,
people that understand. Yeah, I think so, because there's not many directors on the island, you know. They are small enough pools of people and everything, so yeah, it always makes sense to, yeah, you need to have people that can empathize, and you don't need to try and give a huge amount of context and explain a large amount before anyone can understand what you're talking about. So it's,
yeah, I, yeah, mean, there are, look, the process, they're the, like, kind of knockbacks are baked into the process, whether it's, you know, you know, struggles around funding, or you know, kind of challenges around kind of, you know, storytelling, or, you know, or you know, people changing their minds, or the various, you know, kind of like the and, you know, and then the process of screening your work is hugely exposing, and, you know, and like everything about there, the, yeah, knockbacks are built into the process. So, you know, it's very important, I think, to have a support structure in place, whether that is other filmmakers, or, you know, just getting a sense of you know, real life outside of the industry.
Yeah, absolutely. We can get very sucked into it, and I think also because the job can be, I don't know if exciting is quite the right word, but it contains a lot of novelty, and especially, like, if you're going between different projects within different spaces, you're getting to see so many different lives and so many different aspects of things, and I think that can be quite, yeah, it can be quite a lot to just try and take in, and then on top of that, if you're making a project about it, then trying to condense that down and maybe see it from an audience's perspective as well, because it's very important, you need these projects to be entertaining, so an audience will even want to see it. And then I suppose that brings up distribution. So then once have the funding, I guess a lot of the time that might also have some sort of distribution routes maybe attached to it as well. But you have sort of, yeah, is there sort of a particular stream that you generally would look at there? Would be sort of festivals and then broadcast, or festivals then look to see if it might be picked up for cinema, or...
Yeah, I mean, again, I mean, it changes every time. And so, you know, so for the documentary that I'm making now with Justice for Magdalene, so we would have Orti and Arte, the kind of French and German kind of broadcaster would have been involved in funding. The broadcast rights to some degree are given away during the process of garnering funding. So and that wouldn't have been the case, for example, with Mrs. Robinson. So we had kind of, you know, it's still on its festival run at the moment, and also obviously as you mentioned, from the 23rd of August, then it's going to be in various cinemas around the country. I think there isn't always a standard, you know. I suppose it's ideal to kind of feel that you can have a festival run and then followed by kind of a cinema run, followed by, you know, maybe a streamer. But I think it's a process of negotiation, and, you know, the most important thing really is to get it made.
Yeah, get it made, get it out there. Yeah. Thank you very much for joining us on the podcast today. This has been a fantastic conversation, and everyone get yourselves out to the cinema August 23rd. It is quite an important thing, isn't it, when a film comes out, especially like an Irish film, that people see it quite early. So the viewer or the ticket sales are there essentially to hopefully bring things out further. And it's a story that really, I think, a lot of people would really appreciate seeing. So thank you very much.
Thanks a million, Luke.